was about to say, welcome to People and Culture Day. I'm a person, you're a person, we have culture, you're in the right room. And so what I got to do is change the slides. Give me a second. Here we go. Before I talk about my talk, I want to introduce my buddies. On the poster out there, it says, where all the speakers have their photos, it says under my name, author. And I guess I am an author, I know that, but I'm also a baseball fan. I love Shakespeare, things like that. And I really think of myself as a partner in a company called the Atlantic Systems Guild, and that's the six of us. There's six of us, three from the U.S. and three from Europe. And that's why we call ourselves Atlantic. And we fancy ourselves basically consultants. We do mostly consulting, and we do a lot of writing. And so just from upper left-hand corner, the gentleman looking at his shoes is James Robertson, who's actually Australian, but he is married to the woman immediately below him, Suzanne Robertson, who is English, and they live in London. We have a little London office, and they've written Complete Systems Analysis as a book. Well, they're now writing the third edition of Mastering the Requirements Process. In the lower left is Peter Ruschka. He is Austrian by birth. He lives in Aachen, Germany. He wrote A Process for System Architecture and Requirements Engineering. There I am in the top corner, an old photo where I still have some dark hair. Below me is Steve McMenamin, who co-authored a book that I think is an amazingly landmark book called Essential Systems Analysis. Steve has decided to go into real work rather than being a consultant. He's full-time a CIO, and he pulled the short straw. He's got a real tough job. He's CIO at Hawaiian Electric. And below Steve is Tom DeMarco. Tom lives in Camden, Maine, on the Atlantic Ocean, and eats lobsters. And he and I wrote People Wear Together, and we're thinking about third edition coming out of that. And he and I wrote Waltzing with Bears, Managing Risk on Software Projects. And Tom is actually a fiction writer as well. He has a novel that's been published called Dark Harbor House and a collection of short stories. And what I want to talk about is the outcome after we wrote a book. And the book we wrote is called Adrenaline Junkies and Template Zombies, right? Understanding Patterns of Project Behavior. We got together, and all six of us wrote this book, which to me, I must admit, I was the only one who thought this. I thought this is a deeply bad idea to have five other co-authors. I don't know if you've ever tried to write with another person. It's a real team-building experience. Just to have one, to have five, is amazing. And so we did it. There was no blood, but there were tears. And now, because my friends have shown that that maxim is true, I don't know if you heard it, but humans are incapable of recreating vivid pain, right? And the idea is it's there so women will have more than one child, is what I've heard. But we're going to try to write another book, and we're starting another book. And as Mr. T says, I predict pain, but it may come out. But the idea of patterns, there are about 90 some patterns in the book, good and bad, and I want to talk to you about them because they kind of cut against the grain of what a lot of people, I think, tend to think about. And so I wanted to talk for an hour with you about that. So first of all, let me show you. Whoop, come on. Yeah, a pattern. I got this, again, amateur theory. Humans are hardwired to recognize patterns. I think it might be a survival survival instinct. We like patterns. You know, I don't know about you, but I've got a dog. I live right in New York City. I live in Manhattan on the West Side. And so my dog and I get up at 6 in the morning. By the time I get my jeans on and get out at 6:15, and my dog and I watch the seasonal patterns because we can go across the street to a park, and it's nice. And I like it. Even when it's 6:15 in the morning in New York and it's pitch black out and it's winter and you got to bundle up, I grew up in the Northeast, so, you know, if there are four seasons, it's wintertime. This is the way it's supposed to be. You know, and we just had a big snowstorm just the Saturday before Halloween, and, it did a lot of damage in Connecticut, but it's unsettling. It's like, this is not what's supposed to be happening right now. These are monarch butterflies. I know people are from all over the world. If you look at the Hall of Flags out there, these are monarch butterflies, and they have an amazing migration pattern. I don't know how much you know about this, but these little critters, they're beautiful, migrate hundreds, if not thousands of miles. So where, let's see if I can point with this. Where I live, the New England monarchs get down to the Everglades for winter. Seattle monarchs, for some reason, decide to winter in Eureka, California. Eureka must be cool. If you ever get to beautiful Monterey, California, which is there, there's actually a monarch butterfly park right on the coast. If you're at the right time, literally there are tens of thousands of butterflies on this small park coating the trees. The interesting thing about the monarchs is they come down to the south, they lay eggs, the next generation of monarchs go back to where they started. The next generation of monarchs somehow knows how to get back down. There is some evidence, and again, this is not hard proof yet, the monarchs are encoded to go to a tree, not a location. They literally, they're looking at the genetic history of the monarchs. The grandson visited his grandma's tree, kind of thing. Pretty amazing things. And so these are migratory patterns. I know there's a couple of people from New Zealand here, and they'll know what this is. This gentleman happens to be a Maori of New Zealand, and they do a pattern of tattoos. And they are, it's very interesting. If you've ever been to New Zealand, sorry, you're walking around New Zealand, you meet one of these gentlemen, it's ferocious looking. You know, you just kind of want to back off. They are perfectly symmetrical tattoos. You can't quite see it. So for the New Zealanders, the Maori culture is really embedded in New Zealand. So for instance, New Zealand is now the Rugby World Cup champions, if you didn't know that, which is a huge deal in New Zealand. And before the games, the All Blacks, is the name of the New Zealand rugby teams, do something called the haka, which is a Maori, I think they call it posturing dance. It's basically a war dance to intimidate your foes. So they stand at midfield in a line, stick their tongues out, and make ferocious gestures and chant and shout as a way to, you know, get the juices flowing. And the team is usually a lot of rather large, strong, young, ferocious Maoris. And if I were the French, I'd think about going back to Paris, you know. And they beat the French in the final in a close game. Anyway, so this is a Maori one. This is a pattern language. This is a what you would probably call an Irish knit sweater. It really is actually from the Aran Islands. And the pattern is a language. The pattern declares the village that the fisherman is from. And it may not be totally true, maybe apocryphal, but the notion was the water off of Ireland is so cold, the fishermen never learn to swim. It only prolongs the agony. You go into the water, you're going to die of hypothermia very quickly. So you have your sweater on. When you die, eventually you are cast up upon the shore. Someone finds you and reads your sweater and sends you home. That kind of thing. It's kind of an interesting pattern. For you non-Americans, here's a very American pattern. This is an American football pattern. This is called a slant pattern. It's a pass pattern. And the little X's and O's are the good guys and the bad guys, one team versus another. And the key in American football is the quarterback who throws the ball where he thinks the person who's going to catch it will be by the time the ball gets there. If he throws the ball to that person, the defense will intercept the ball, will clobber the guy. So it's all kind of a timing issue. And so this is called a slant pattern. And here's a pattern that most of us, even in America, don't understand, unless you happen to be from Texas. This is Texas line dancing pattern, where men and women, and it appears to me in this photo that it's important for women from Texas to dance with beer bottles. I'm not sure if that's a requirement, but many adults get in line, and usually you have a coach, and here she is, and they play both kinds of music, country and Western, and you do a dance, repeating over and over again, you know, until the music stops. You don't even get to hold your partner. I'm from New York, don't ask me to explain, but this is a very common Friday night, Saturday night pattern in Texas. In our world, We have patterns. I should go back and look. A pattern language is not really our world of software development, but it became a huge cult hit. And I'm trying to recollect, like the late 70s, Christopher Alexander and a bunch of other architects wrote this notion. And it says a pattern language, towns, buildings, construction. And it's architectural patterns for how humans interact in towns and villages. And it's a fascinating kind of look at patterns, kind of a transformation of that book into a technical patterns book. Is probably my favorite patterns book of all is the old design patterns of Lycides et al. In terms of OO design, where we're looking at standard patterns of construction. And so we have all sorts of kinds of patterns we can look at. And my thesis is humans naturally gravitate toward recognizing patterns. We want to recognize them. We can't help but recognize them, right? And now for our patterns that the Adrenaline Junkies book talks about, our patterns can be good or bad or neutral. We call them patterns. Between you and me, they're kind of like habits, corporate habits, organizational habits. So they're patterns like children enjoy and need exercise on a regular basis. That would be a good pattern. Like not only is it good for their health, but they truly enjoy it. And if you've been a mom or are a mom or a dad, you remember when the kids are about that age. I remember coming home from work, and we have two sons who are now grown and married. You could tell when they didn't get enough running around. They're just little grouchy sons of bitches. You know, geez. And you just thought, you know, okay, let's have an emergency park session over at the playground. You know, we'll take the flashlights because this is not going to be a good night. That kind of thing. And so, you know, that would be a good pattern. Then there's the couch potato pattern. And again, if you're not from this country, apart from general obesity, we got a huge problem with childhood obesity going on now, where, you know, kids come home to play video games and watch mind-numbing things and eat potato chips. And then there are neutral patterns, where they're almost assumptions where you don't even think about them. Like, in our culture, most boys and girls get different kinds of haircuts. I never even thought about that for a while. Why? I mean, I don't think, is it sexual attachment to what constitutes beauty? You know, what a beautiful man looks like as against a beautiful woman? You know, I don't know. But it's a neutral one. It just, there's a pattern. Boys tend to get certain kinds of haircuts. Girls tend to get other kinds of haircuts. I don't know what it means. So, the thing about patterns, though, that I want to talk to you about is, and again, about people and our work. Patterns, I think we've always underestimated them. They can be hugely strong, powerful drivers in the way we behave at our work. I don't know if anybody knows William DeMent. William DeMent is probably, and I'm guessing, the U.S.'s foremost sleep expert. He's at Stanford University Medical School, and he is been doing experiments with sleep and sleep deprivation, etc., for, I don't know, he's got to be at least 50, 60 years old. I love the quote, right? Dreaming permits each and every one of us to be quietly and safely insane every night of our lives. And if you've ever seen him on TV, he's like the most frustrated man in America. He has got hard evidence about sleep and how it correlates to performance. And he just says, you know, I've got irrefutable evidence. Other people in my world have looked at our evidence. It's very simple. The typical adult male and female need about 8 to 9 hours of sleep every night to have maximized their physical capabilities and their mental capabilities. And this man has been saying this for years. This is not in dispute. And in America, I would love to know what percentage of people get 8 to 9 hours of sleep every night. Right? And I think it's a darn little number. But everybody tells us that, but we go, nope, can't do it. You know, sorry, we're going to do our 5 or whatever, and then we'll drink Red Bull on the subway in New York, you know, or whatever people do. You know, and the poor guy must be horribly frustrated. Right? I mean, if you think about it, I was looking at the Hall of Flags out here that represent all the nations. Have you ever been to Spain? It's crazy in Spain. They used to have siesta in the afternoon. They don't have it anymore. But they have, their culture stayed the same way. You go to Madrid, restaurants open for the American tourists about 9 p.m. You don't see a Spaniard with their kids until 10:30. And then that guy's going to be at work at 8:30 in the morning. And the kid's going to go to school. And, you know, they're having dessert about 1 a.m. And it's Tuesday. Yeah. I don't get it, but it explains the fall of the euro. I have no idea. Right? So they can be really powerful. So here's my thing. I think habits, patterns trump best practices. I think, you know, why is it so hard to talk about, well, to get best practices? One, let me say in public, I got a big problem with best practices. Right? It implies we're all done. This is a best practice. This is it. End of the line. Follow the best. We're there. And best practices also implies unequivocally the best practice. I mean, we should back off and say, really pretty good practice some of the time. I'd sign up on that one. You know, great practice in some cases. That kind of thing. I mean, the software industry is not ever going to totally coalesce because software is a medium, right? It's a way we translate things into a reality. And so, you know, I think of it, software, the software industry is about as much of an industry as the plastics industry. You know, there's a plastics conference in Las Vegas every September, and thousands upon thousands of people who make stuff in plastic converge on Caesar's Palace. And it's the first morning before the plenary session, and you sit down next to someone and you introduce yourself. And you say, I make plastic prosthetic devices. I make artificial knees and hips in my company. And the guy next to you says, I make the little green soldiers. You know, little green soldiers the kids love to play with. And you start to chat and you decide to go out to dinner together because you have so much in common. It never happens that way. You know, somebody says, I'm a software developer. I have no idea what you do. What kinds of things are you building? Or even better, my favorite one is, I'm a software project manager. Man, clueless. I don't know if you're a shirt sleeve manager with, you know, a team of three, counting yourself, or you're a manager of a team of 300 in four sites. Right? It's a slightly different job, you know, that kind of thing. And so, for me, one of the reasons where you look at every good practice, I'll just call them good practices, they failed somewhere. They don't take. And you keep going, what's going on? You know, there's not a practice you can name that I can't find you someplace that said, we sincerely tried our best to do that, and we just gave up. It just died on the vine. You know, we tried to make the souffle, and it just kept falling down. You know, so we gave up on souffles. And I've got this haunting feeling that we way overestimate the process and way underestimate the culture the process is in. And that's what I want you to think about. Well, especially when you're trying to make changes for the better in your particular organization, in your world, you've got to understand the fishbowl you're living in. Here's a picture of my dad, my late wonderful dad. My dad was a mathematics professor all his career. And I was a young guy, and I think we were going out to visit grandma and grandpa. And I was sitting with him in the back, and we were doing something. And I was complaining about something at work. And he had a big smile on his face when he said this. He said, only mathematicians and physicists prefer to learn by concept. All others prefer to learn by example. And I don't know why that went into my permanent memory, but again, as a consultant, I walk around and people all the time, you start to talk about things conceptually, and they'll say, you know, you start talking about qualities of a good set of requirements. And people will say, show me a good spec. You know, so they're going to do pattern recognition. I'll follow the good pattern. Show me a crummy spec. I'll avoid that pattern. And I think it's true for the majority of. So I want to show you patterns by example, and for a little bit, and then I'm going to jump back to the concept, and then I'm going to come back to the patterns again. So yesterday, I just wandered around, and I came up with two, quickly, yesterday morning, two patterns for here. First one, oops, sorry. This was a secret photo I took in the back room on the speakers only. And this is the I'm paying attention pattern. And only old farts will get this, by the way. So if you get it, you're an old fart. It's perfectly acceptable to multitask at work, except when in a one-on-one exchange. You know, and everybody has their laptops on, you know, and it is not taking notes via laptop. It's kind of, if listener's a little bit boring, I'll check my email. And that's perfectly acceptable. You know? As a white-haired old fart, this is a new pattern. Not too long ago, this would be called a massive insult. If you went to a project team meeting and opened up your laptop and started to surf your email, your boss would not be a happy man or woman, right? But it's a change. It is now totally acceptable, and so we old farts have to get over it. Right? So here's another one, just another pattern. This one is a neutral pattern, the coffee pattern. In some places, good coffee is expected. In others, it's rare. And I cannot find anybody, for those of you who are not here, I think Seattle is the first city in the United States of America to wake up and be willing to pay for really good coffee. And I talk to people from the Seattle area and say, what happened? How did that come to be? You know, is it all your cold, wet weather and you just need that caffeine boost in the morning to face February? Or, you know, what is it? You know, people say, well, Starbucks started here. And I think that's effect, not cause. I remember, you know, I lived in New York a long time. I remember coming out and being absolutely dumbstruck, going by in my rental car a gas station, and the biggest sign on the gas station was espresso. And I was just like, what the heck is going on in Seattle? Right? And it has swept across the United States. But Seattle is still, to me, the mothership of good coffee in the U.S. So if you're not from the United States and you like coffee, you're in the right place. Wait till you go to Atlanta. Ooh. Wow. BYOC. Right? Okay. So that's the coffee pattern, a neutral pattern. But it's, you know, and I'm not saying why it's a pattern, and I don't know, but you can definitely see it and observe it. So here is back to concept. The organizational culture is a set of behavior governing rules. They are usually unwritten and unarticulated, both. They are almost always unwritten because they are not necessarily really fun rules. But they are commonly understood or learned and obeyed by all members of the organization. So, for instance, let me give you a look and then the pattern. Right? Here's a candidate rule. Is this your company? You don't have to admit it, yes or no. If you've committed to a delivery of a software product by a given date and you find you can't make it, then you can go back to your boss and ask for more time. But the pattern that is interesting is once. You can go back once to ask for more time. Right? To put it very simply, in many organizations, that may not be yours, patterns are not laws. So some of the patterns I show you or talk about, you might go, I've never seen that. Right? We've got existence proof for every one of our patterns. These are not anomalies or made up. But put it this way. Think about this. Which is better, to go back to your boss and ask for 1 3-month slip, or go back to your boss and ask, over time, ask for 3 1-month slip? It gets you to the same finish line, but in most companies, there's a preferred path in terms of your career prospects. You go to the well once, right? And then your boss goes to the well once. That second slip, it smells of incompetence or something horrible. And so you find that, you know, somebody says, for instance, what happens is I'm a young project manager. Things are not going good, but I'm not sure how bad they're going. So I don't know what to ask for yet. So I wait until I really know how bad it is. And then I make sure I cover my butt by asking for a big hunk late. You know, it's the shock and upset. You know, you're at month 8 of an 11-month project, and you go to your boss and say, "I can't believe it, boss. We're going to be 4 months late." As though you had an epiphany in the shower. Right? No. You knew you were going to be behind schedule. It was, you didn't know enough to know, I go to the well once, I take my hit, and then I can proceed. So going early to your boss and saying, "Boss, we're off target, you know, that kind of thing, is you know, not good, because the boss says, "Well, how bad is it?" And you go, "I don't know," which is another pattern, right? You can't say, "I don't know," right? I literally had someone say a couple of years ago, "Tim, to understand our company, right, it is better to be wrong than uncertain." That is an amazing one. Right? We have to pretend everything's under control, because saying "I don't know" means there are powers that are beyond me to control it. I'm not sure. I've got some degree of uncertainty or loss, or I'm lost somewhere along the line. So I will fib. "We will deliver February 21st. And as an old fart, I say, "At what time?" Okay. So this is a rule. By the way, one of the interesting things is, as a risk management zealot as well, I look at the Agile folks, and one of the things they do is they're trying to attempt to stop this nonsense. Right? By having multiple iterations and things, you kind of get a realistic checkpoint as to where you truly are. If you really play the game by the rules and have a real iteration that means something, where you actually, you know, actually test deliver. It's hard to fake the shock and the amazement and surprise. Gee, we're 4 months late when you were 8 months down the road. If you're claiming to be reasonably agile, the warning lights should have been going off from the get-go. That kind of thing. And let me say something from the people side of things, as the people are called co-author. I want to say this because it's so obvious, but I think people need to drum this in. The agile development people in the last 10 years have reminded us something that has always been true, and that now, you know, we can't keep pretending it's not true. If you want a high-performance team delivering a high-quality product with the thrill of pride of workmanship, nothing beats a small, co-located team. Nothing. You want to do all your fancy-dancy distributed teams, virtual teams, all the rest of it, you're paying a penalty. Admit it, get over it. Maybe you have to do it. I'm a big boy. There are many situations where you can't co-locate the key players. But understand, this is not the high-performance team you could have had if you somehow miraculously could have brought those people together so they could smell each other's breath, so they could look each other in the eye, they could tap each other on the shoulder, and they could work together. And so I, for you agile folks, I truly thank you for rubbing the world's nose in something that has always been true. So that's a candidate rule. Right? So here's one from our book. And I just picked a couple for you. This is from a 1967 Paul Newman movie that if you're in our business and you have never seen this movie, you just got to go to Netflix. This is I was a kid then, of course, but I was amazed it didn't win the Academy Award for Best Picture. Cool Hand Luke. Luke is a rascal, and Luke goes to prison in the southern part of the United States, and he's in a prison work camp, paving roads, digging trenches. And the captain, who's a guy named Strother Martin, plays captain. Luke is always acting up and getting sent to solitary confinement and penalized. And whenever Luke acts up and Strother Martin has to discipline him, "I can't do it right. I need somebody in the audience who can do it right." He has this great southern accent, and he says very calmly, "What we have here is a failure to communicate." And I can't tell you how many organizations I go to where people say, "We just don't communicate well here. And then we have to learn to be better communicators." And there's the little voice in my head going, at this point in my career, "Bull. You communicate just fine. Right? What you've got is dispute. What you've got is people hear you loud and clear, but they don't like what they're hearing." Right? And that's what's going on. There's this kind of wonderful kind of view of silence is consent, where that is not an assumption you can make. And so all sorts of fundamental disagreements are really papered over with this very kind of neutral view that, gee, we're just not communicating well enough. You know, that kind of thing. We have to try better to discuss things. You know, that kind of thing. So that's Cool Hand Luke. Here's one that is near and dear to me. When I actually wrote the first round of this one in the book. The dead fish pattern. It's near and dear to me because it just drives me nuts. The dead fish pattern, the pattern itself is, from day one, the project has no chance of meeting its goals. Most people in the project know this and say nothing. This is not a project that from day one is going to fail. This is going to limp into production. But this is a project that is going to let us down. It's going to be late. It's going to be over budget. It's going to deliver less functionality than was originally promised. It's going to run into a couple of more releases to get everything done than what we originally hoped for. And now the ironic thing about the dead fish is a couple things. One, this is a very common pattern. Now, I wish I could find organizations who go, I have no idea what you're talking about, Tim. Right? And the key notion here is two. One, this is at the get-go. The early constraints of deadline and all the rest make the probability of complete success tiny. And the scary thing is, people in the project know this, but don't seem to jump up and go, wait a minute, you're slating me for defeat. I refuse to join a team slated for failure. This is totally ridiculous. Right? Now, I'm not saying every project should be a complete victory. Right? Where we relax all the parameters so we all can win. You know, it's like Little League now where every kid gets a trophy. Oh, man. By the way, if you're a project manager, when my kids were younger, I learned a lot of good project management skills by being a coach on a Little League team. It's worth it. It's better than going to PMI. Trust me. Most is better than going to PMI. But anyway, to me, the notion that they know is kind of interesting, and they don't say anything. Right? And I'll come back to that in a bit. How can we accept projects formulated to fail? I mean, to me, I'll ask you rhetorically, and you can, at break, please come talk to me. Have you ever been on a project that is a complete victory? Where you just went, woohoo! On time, on budget. Not only that, we delivered all the functionality, and it's the Rock of Gibraltar. Our customers are clueless on that. This is good stuff. We look at each other and just go, yeah. You know, we built it for us, not for them. Pearls before swine. Right? But we know good stuff when we see it. And damn, that was good. Right? Now, here's the thing. Almost everyone in this room has probably been on one or two. Right? Which is, you know, you think, how many projects have I been in my career? And so it's almost like an out-of-body experience, right? You have old guys in your company like me, and you know, people say, back in 1983, we had this amazing project. Aliens visited our corporation. Everything went right. Kind of thing. You know? And it's just, to me, you got to laugh, because otherwise you're going to cry. No, you know, really. I mean, you sit there, and you know, everybody smiles it right away. Right? Unless you're just a kid out of school and you don't even know how to work yet. You know, you're just learning what it is to work in an organization. I love kids because they don't know what they can't do. I think every organization should be full of under 25-year-olds in our business. They just keep us old farts really loose and goosey and alive and happy, you know, that kind of thing. But everybody's been around the block smells it right away. And it's just like, here we go. Here we go. I've seen this happen before. You know, this is bad Groundhog Day project. You know, we've lived this one. We're going to be late. They're going to ask us to postpone summer vacations. We are going not to make the delivery. People will not make eye contact with us in the hall. Okay? They'll put the screws to us, and we will eventually deliver in late October,
holding our noses. Congratulations, the release is out.
Yay, yay, yay. What a great project. The great thing about as getting old, and none of you are like me, is you get fearless and you just go, life is too short to be on this kind of a project. This is just not what I had in mind when I was growing up. You know, let's limp some stuff into production over and over again. Oh boy. You know, so people smile and then they hunker down. Right? You know, everybody talks about teams and all the rest of it. If you've had a success, if you've been on a victory, you're a dangerous person. You're a dangerous person because you know what it feels like, and you're going, I'd like to happen again before I retire. I'd like another victory. I'd like to get the ring. You know, the World Series ring. You know, it's like the ball players, they don't care about the money. They want the ring. They want to say, I did it. I was on a team that we had an amazing season, and we blew through everybody, and by God, you know, I got a ring. And, you know, we may be very sophisticated folks, but knowing that you were on a team that actually had a complete victory, in many ways, is more important than being an individual has victory. Some things are really sweet. We're communal animals. There's something really sweet about saying, you know, the seven of us did something that none of us could have done alone. We had different kinds of skills and different abilities. We got together. We worked our asses off for 14 months, and we nailed it. Yeah. And you watch teams who've done these things. They have reunions. Right? I'm sure you can tell stories. People who don't even work at the company come back once every 6 months or a year or whatever, and go have a beer in a bar to talk about the good old days. Do you remember that 1983 season at our company? You know, and we built a great piece of software. Right? That kind of thing. And everybody just hunkers down if they don't. You know, it's kind of like, I'll work hard so no one will blame me. It gets very difficult. No. I'm not for the blaming organization, but I'm going to blame. You know, who's to blame for this loathsome situation? And since I'm willing to say this, me. I don't know what happened to me and my generation where I'm not saying we were cowards, but somehow we totally blew this. And now that my generation is waning, you guys are waxing, I would really like it, if nothing else, we started to figure out more and more ways to prevent this kind of, you know, beaten wife syndrome of projects. You can't leave. It's not that bad. Yes, it is that bad. It sucks. And again, I don't want total victory. Projects should be full of risks and full of challenges. And having victory every time means victory is meaningless. But come on. One a decade? That's really ridiculous. And so I am passing the gauntlet to people under 40 and say, any way, from any direction we go, we really need to correct this dominant feature of our cultures where, you know, late limping in is totally okay. It becomes the norm, right? We were late, we were over budget, we didn't quite get the job done. We had a few minor, production incidents, all this kind of quasi speech, and it's debilitating. Right? So, think of it the other way around. If you have no dead fish, people think they can make it. They try really hard. Somebody says, "My God, we can win on this. Let's get going. This is shaping up. We could nail this. We could build something we're really proud of." Right? People will learn. They'll learn from each other. Right? I'm not hunkering down if I think we have success, and I'm really good at some aspect of something. I'm more than happy to talk to my teammates, and I'm more than happy to take the responsibility to kind of lead this part of the effort or whatever, rather than just say, give me my piece to do, I'll do it, and let's see what happens. Right? Experiment. One of the things I've always thought was really weird, maybe I'm getting romantic. We are in the most intellectual profession I know. We're in an amazing profession. You know, groups of men and women get together, smart people solving really tricky problems, basically only doing good things most of the time in terms of the society. And we're all new at this stuff. We're all new. We're feeling our way. If anybody should be experimenting like mad, it's us. right? We should all be saying, pretty good practices, pretty good tools. There's infinite possibility for improvement. And yet, experiment, you see, experiment is like, well, because we're hunkering down. You know, we're going to be late as is. If we try something new, it's only going to get worse. Rather than going, hey, let's give it a shot. And we're smart. If it doesn't pan out, we can pull the ripcord, we can abort, we can try something else. But, you know, you see all these kind of, you know, let's have a toe in the water start at this. No one ever dives in and says, let's really give it a shot on a real project. And I think that's just fear. And I think it comes out of that. And let me say, last thing, pride. You know, from my point of view, we're all craftspeople. You know, we're not engineers or whatever. We are master craftsmen, master craftswomen, whatever that means, craftsmen, people. And the pride of work is an enormously satisfying thing. Forget salary. Salary doesn't give you pride. Now, you know, insurance, health insurance doesn't give you pride. You know, it's part and parcel of the contract. But when you build something that you and your teammates are really proud of, you know that you happily sign your name to that system. That's an amazing feel, an intangible feeling that, you know, I think draws most of us into this, or at least the ones that hang around a long enough time. So we can be talking about patterns today. What I propose is that what I'd like to do is, you know, strike up conversations at lunch. Lunch is a good pattern anyway. And then we've got tonight's reception, and that's a conference pattern. Now, at the end of the day, we go drink beer together or whatever we're going to do, and maybe listen to vendors, but we thank them for the beer. And so it's kind of interesting to talk about them. They are organizational patterns. There are project patterns. There are individual patterns within the organization. Right? So you can talk at almost any level. Right? So for instance, just give as a quick side. One of the things I've seen as an organizational pattern in many organizations is the organization consistently understaffs test. And I'm not sure why that happens, but I see that as a dominant pattern in our industry nowadays. That those organizations that have separate tests, those testers are just stretched like a drum skin, right? And you get horrible ripple effects. You know, you were supposed to get four testers at this time, but the other project had nothing to do with you, was late, so they're over there, so now you have one tester, not four. And the one tester is the new hire scratching his head going, huh? You know, that kind of thing. And now you start to slide because somebody else slid. And I'm not sure why it seems chronic, but that's a classic, what I would call, organizational pattern. That is not a project manager's problem. Something's going in the organization that we've got an imbalance of roles and skills. Right? Then there's kind of project patterns, and then there's individual patterns. You know, like, you know, how do individuals get treated? How do they get hired? How do they get ongoing training? All those kinds of patterns that come in. So since networking is always one of the best things in any conference, I figure sit down at a table, even if you don't know anybody, and say, we've got a great pattern in our organization. Here's something we're really trying to propagate, and it seems to really help us. Or, have you ever seen this happen? This happens every once in a while in our projects, and when it does, it's devastating. One of the things I want you to think about, this sounds strange, naming the patterns and describing them succinctly is really important, because then it becomes part of the lingua franca. You know, people say, this is a dead fish. And everybody doesn't have to say anything else. People will start to nod. We have a pattern called endless huddle. And endless huddle, this might be you, but it's us. Endless huddle is no decision is ever really final. It can always be revisited. And it's a project pattern. Right? And you see that on some projects. You know, decisions, no matter how they come out, somebody will bring it up again and again. You know, and you're endlessly huddling on it. And it's interesting because the six of us, the guild, we are chronic endless huddlers. If a decision is made of the six of us and somebody doesn't like it, give them 24, 48, 72 hours and it'll come up again. And the interesting thing is it stopped because somebody will start and somebody goes, endless huddle. And we move on. All I have to do is say endless huddle and everybody goes, it is. And we keep going. And so naming of the patterns, I think, is really important. Trying to describe, not in huge amounts, but succinctly what exactly it is. If it's something that is damaging, you know, then you can start to say, what are the root cause or causes? What could we do to stamp out this behavior? And if it's something that you think is a positive pattern, like exercise, how do we propagate this? How do we maximize the probability the next project will find this as an advantage? Okay, so here's my stuff if you want to talk to me later. It'll be on the stick when we come back. And I left some time. Here you are looking into the not too clear future, but I thought I would leave a minute or two for patterns, questions, comments. What do you think? Stunned silence pattern.
That never happens, right?
Right. This is actually a pattern that no one will have a question or a comment, and then I'll go outside and 15 people will talk with me, which is fine. You don't want to talk in the audience, but I see somebody waving madly over there, really loud.
I think you touched on a very interesting issue about dysfunctional organizational pattern of not staffing test functions. Have you explored some of the reasons behind that? I can tell you we suffer from that at our organization.
Right.
I'll offer you a couple of insights that we have, but I'm curious to know whether or not these are pervasive in the attending company.
Okay. So I touched on the wild card of the understaffed test, and he's asking for, do you have any kind of rationale why this seems to be pervasive? I think there are a couple of things going on. One, testers don't make stuff. I know it sounds silly, but they become second-class citizens in some ways. Many organizations, management are king, and many organizations, developers are king. Especially if you're building software as a product or something like that. Often a great developer is you know, in the hall of fame for the group, and it's not the managers. It's the great developers who are leading. You never see an organization where test is honored or even distinguished. I mean, let's be honest. They are second-class citizens. The other thing is, we can talk in private, great testers are good developers. And a lot of organizations just don't buy that. I've got an organization in Cambridge in England that I consult with, and it's a great organization. They build software tools. They build complex software tools. They have the greatest test staff I've ever met. And basically, they're writing code. They're building test frames. They're doing all sorts of stuff. They would be excellent developers in almost any organization I see. But their job is defined as test, but they're not monkey testers, right? They are really master craftsmen, and I think most organizations don't understand that, don't want to pay for that, don't see that. They're hard to find. You put an ad out for a tester, right? And I'm being a snob. You're going to get 25 mouth breathers before you find someone with their brain engaged. I'm sorry. I mean, most people are clueless about really what they're doing. So it's hard to find a real professional tester. It's very hard. So it becomes one of those things where, you know, put it this way. When the budget cut comes, you know, we cut, you know, the three T's, travel, training, and test. Thank you. Right? Oh, yeah, that's the way it goes. You know, you developers are going to have to do a little more testing. So, you know, I'll meet you outside for coffee and we can chat. Yes, sir, in the back.
I have one question and maybe an editorial comment.
Sure.
I'll start with the editorial comment. Could we please not use the word monkey in the context of people? I find it a demeaning term. It has some negative connotations.
Didn't mean them in any negative context.
I understand that. But I just want to raise awareness to the fact that some find it offensive.
Note taken.
It's been used a couple of times in this conference, so I'm not picking out you. But my question is, when does a law or a principle or a rule become a pattern? Or
could you
describe the difference?
Okay, if it's a law, it's not never a pattern. It's a law. Right? Ohm's law is a law. It's not Ohm's pattern. Right? So I think it has to do with repeatability, where you this is not a one-time occurrence. You have seen it in different organizations. You've seen this behavior multiple times. Right? So it's not a theory. It's not a law. It's more kind of a heuristically driven human abstraction. And we're looking at and abstracting out saying, this behavior looks a lot like that behavior. They're slightly different. You know, I think that's a snake and that's a snake. That's a brown snake and that's a green snake. But I think there's snake in common here. You know, that's the way I think about it. Put it this way. We're not trained sociologists here. We're experienced observers, and that's all I will claim as my expertise here. You know, where you go to the same office every day, I'm in a different office every week, so I've got a broader scope.
I have a question.
Yeah.
About collaboration.
Okay, where are you? And wave your hand. Oh, there you are.
Yeah. In all of your observations, it seems to me that our agile theories tell us that it's good to, you talked about co-location and collaboration with our business users and the testers and everybody, right?
Right.
But of course, I always observe that we have conferences like this with people like us who really are excited about this stuff, but I never see conferences where we are with customers, have a common goal. It's like we speak different languages. Have you seen any observed any patterns about successfully bridging the gap between the technical world and the business world? Does that make sense, what I'm getting at?
Yeah. I must admit, I've seen organizations that seem to be much better at it than others. But it's hard, you know, I should ask my five compatriots, but I can't think of a pattern that was repeated often enough that I would claim it to be a pattern. One of the interesting things is the responsibility of the business people as members of the project, to me. This is not a pattern, but where people come out of the business line, for instance, and really believe they have a responsibility of engagement, really interesting things happen. At the same time, when the team decides that their language is not their local dialect to try to get a good system built for this part of the organization, that also appears to be a sign of health. But it's very individual. Yeah, it's very true. I mean, the conference world, et cetera, looks like it's the customer relationship is taken on by the business. We're the customers. You go build this, rather than any sort of, and I kind of don't like the word, but partnership. You know, you can be the customer when the system's already built and you're deciding which one you want to buy that's already built. When something's being built for you, you are no longer a customer. You're an active member, right? You know, you can buy a modular house and have it a slab poured and have the house dropped onto the slab, and you're a customer. But when you have property and you want a custom-built house, you are no longer a customer. You are a key participant in what the outcome of that house. And if you're not there, you're going to be very unhappy. You can't play customer in that role. On the other side, let me point out a couple things. There's a guy that many of you never heard of who's when I was a kid, he was the number one software engineer on the planet. A guy named Harlan Mills. He was an IBM fellow. And some of his writing's still around. And Mills is amazing. And at one time, people were talking to him at a conference years ago, International Conference on Software Engineering. And it was basically this kind of question. And he stood there, and he's a very tall, elegant gentleman. And he said, "There's always progress through death." And I was a young man. I just laughed, but now I get it. I totally get it. You know, I one of the things I'm feeling really good about is that I look at my sons and their friends. This is the business world is going to change dramatically in terms of just level of techno savvy, and it won't even be called technology. I saw an incredible talk years ago, and I wonder if it's on somewhere on YouTube or whatever. There's another guy who is retired. He may be dead guy. A guy named Alan Kay. I mean, I'm sounding like a really old guy. Alan Kay was at Xerox PARC, which is an amazing place at its time and all the rest. And he gave a talk, and he said, "Let's have a definition for technology." And he said, technology is whatever is around you today, but wasn't around you when you were growing up. He said, I think it's a great definition. And he said, now we need another word. And he said, the technology that was around you when you're growing up and is around you today, what's that called? And he goes, environment. And his basic point was, my technology is my son's environment. And I think, you know, the rising sea of understanding is going to come through the young people who are totally, who you know, the world they have grown up around is, you know, is they are technology without fear, or whatever you want to call it. You know, my wife is an editor, and she's always worried about saving her files and something's going to crash. And then my sons are like, come on. You know, that kind of thing. It's amazing to watch the generational difference. And I'm hoping that we're both going to get closer together. And I am confident the business side is not going to ever look at us as, you know, high priests of the sacred stuff anymore. That's long gone. You know, we are going to have some specialties, but I think they're going to come toward us. And if we've got half a brain in our body, we are going to embrace the people who are walking toward us. And we're going to try to make them survive and thrive and vote higher and higher in the organization. I mean, that it's not going to happen tomorrow, but I got long-term optimism.
Ken?
Yeah.
One more up here?
Sure. Yeah, and then we're going to call it quits. That I'm around all day today. Nothing's worse than a speaker standing alone holding a cup of coffee. It's so sad. You know, hello? So please bother me all day. That would be great. So, yes, last question.
Yeah, my question is I work in an industry that is the pattern, I don't care and wait till I retire. So do you have any insight on motivational patterns or anything that redirects the ship? Yeah.
There's a pattern in the book called Old Dogs. There is. And I'm guessing that your pattern exists because your group is not expanding and everybody's gotten old together. There you go. It's like Karnak. I can read your mind. You know, I don't know how you do this, but you need a massive injection of under 30-year-olds. Right, you know, you need somebody to say, you know, take early retirement, Fred, and we're gonna find a 22-year-old kid in here to loosen us up, and to yank us toward the year 2011. I mean, the place where I see it is exactly that. Usually, organizations that are flat, they, you know, everybody's gotten a year older. The average age of the employees in the IT department are 1 year older every year, and all of a sudden they're white-haired or no-haired. I just heard something. It's not just our understanding. I heard a thing about Boeing, and they're trying this morning. Anybody hear this? They're trying to hold the new 737 construction in Renton, but some amazing number of people who know how to build airplanes are retiring in the next 5 years. You go like, oh, jeez. Talk about, you know, mass amnesia occurring. You know, oops, we forgot how to make planes. I don't know what your position is. You can kind of force feed some things and see who wakes up. Get people out of their comfort zone and say, we're going to use this new technology. We're going to give it a real shot. Who would like to play? If you don't want to play, you don't have to come on this project team, but we're going to do this and see who actually wakes up, no matter what their age is, and says, if this is a real shot, I want to give it a try. You are a zombie in our business when you're not willing to learn stuff that's new. You got a bunch of zombies walking around the office. Right? As a friend of mine calls it, this is slow death. This is, you know, trailing edge of technology, trailing edge of excitement, trailing edge of life. That kind of thing. So that's a real hard one. And you know, just remember, when a guy who's 70 or 65 retires, don't hire somebody who's 45. Go for the 25. You need a whole nother life cycle there. Okay, that's it. So let's go get coffee. Don't forget the coupons, or whatever it was.
Coupons. Yes.
Coupons. Okay. And so come grab me. I'd love to chat with you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Tim.